Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone. I am so excited to jump into our show today. So I'll tell you why. For those of you who don't know, I don't just host this podcast. I also have a practice where I see patients individually and in groups. And I absolutely love running groups. Now, don't get me wrong, I also love providing individual therapy, but there really is something quite amazing about group therapy, something that is just very different than individual. So I will tell you, it is one thing as a therapist to say something to one of my patients, but when someone comes to a group and hears someone else, another normal person who is not a doctor like me or a professional, hear another person openly talking about the very things that they've been feeling or too embarrassed to even admit to themselves or anyone else, it is a completely different experience. They feel less alone, more normal, shocked even, and in a good way. The power of group therapy is something I wish we discussed more. I know most of the time when I initially bring it up to people as an option or to add to their individual treatment, they're hesitant. They don't know what to expect. They don't want to share with other people. And most times they're anxious. But what I wish people knew is that it can be so transformative. Over the years, I've seen group members form connections that are life-altering. And it is through one of my most long-running groups that I became aware of a book about group therapy. A book that was written by someone who had suffered from an eating disorder and entered group therapy herself. I admit I was intrigued, so I went out and read it myself. And I can see why the group brought it to my attention. It was honest, it was real, and as anyone who has listened to my podcast before knows, I truly believe that the more honest and real we can all be, the better. And the easier it will be for all of us to open up and be free of what is hurting us, including all of those eating disorder thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that so many of us are ashamed of and embarrassed of. I know when I was suffering with mine, I was really afraid to open up about everything I was thinking, everything I was doing, everything I was feeling. So after I was done reading this book, I decided, hey, you know what? Let me email the author and ask if she would be a guest on the podcast. And I honestly thought to myself that doing that was pointless because I thought, you know what, this is a complete long shot and there's no way I'm ever going to hear back from her. So can you imagine my surprise when that very same day I received a response from her saying she'd be a guest? Yeah, the same day. Shocking. Really, I was in shock. So I really meant it when I said I'm very excited to jump into our show today because the author of the book is actually here with us today. Christy Tate is a writer and author who writes about addiction, eating disorders, recovery, connection, isolation, achievement, and loneliness. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, McSweeney's, the Los Angeles Review, which is forthcoming, and her debut memoir, Group, How One Therapist and a Group of Strangers Saved My Life, was published fall 2020 by Avid Reader Press. So, Christy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So this is exciting. I have not had anyone on the podcast yet to talk about group or group therapy or their experience with it. So I'm really excited to have you here. You have written this amazing book with your own experience and I'm just excited to hear more about your experience with not only group and your transition, but now that you've written the book, I'm wondering, do you feel like you have any, did you have any different perspective on all of what you went through? Or did you feel like that was a whole nother process?
I do think that writing the book was one way of making sense to myself. what worked. Like, how did my life transform? I knew that I believed my life had been transformed. And I really do give the credit to the process of group therapy. And what has been fascinating since the book came out, I've talked to so many readers, including therapists, people who suffered in some of the ways that I did, or someone whose daughter or mother. And what I realize now is many, many people are really hungry for stories of transformation, ones that are authentic and offer a sense of hope, right? So what I was always frustrated with when I was really struggling, I had been in one-on-one therapy and it didn't move the needle. Now, the reason why it didn't move the needle is because I was lying. I was not bringing, I did not like give forth my full effort. I was too scared. For me, for my set of issues, I consider my eating disorder an addiction. The modality that seemed to unlock me and help me tell the truth for the first time in my whole life was group therapy. And I'm really grateful to be able to talk to people about that because a lot of people don't know it as a tool.
So curious, because I also went through my treatment with eating disorders and recovery, and I often say this, like, I was the worst patient. I lied to my therapist for so long. And I think that also stopped me from really getting better as well. And that's why as a therapist now, I run groups because I found the power in it myself. So when I came, my group actually introduced me to your book. They were like, this is great. This is like being in another group, reading it. And so I'm wondering for you, what do you think it was that allowed you to be more open and honest in a group versus with a one-on-one therapist?
Yeah, I think that what was really the most powerful for me was having other examples. I sat in that group the first day and I watched people. I didn't know them. They were strangers, but they seemed to be doing what looked to me like deep work. And what I meant by that was like telling the truth, being in their feelings, telling hard stories. I mean, this is day one, and I'm sort of thinking we're going to skate on the surface. But immediately, other people were walking ahead of me and they were crying about their family or feeling rage about an argument with the credit card company. And they came to play. And that made me want to do what they were doing. And I feel lucky. I believe I landed in a place that was unorthodox in many ways, but the group kept me feeling safe. And like I was willing to go to darker places because they did it every session too. So I really think that was the key for me, the chemistry of the group. I was a newbie, but everybody else was sort of doing this thing. And I wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to see if I could hack it.
So you said something interesting, like your group is very different than I think most people would think of as group. And even me as a therapist are going, oh my gosh, like this is very different and unconventional, but it worked for you. And so I don't know if you've gotten any feedback from people of, wow, that is not my experience with group at all.
Yes. Even before the book came out, the idea of writing about group therapy and quote, breaking confidences, I was getting side eyes from therapists, just telling them I have a book deal and I wrote a book about group therapy. There was a lot of pearl clutching, like, oh, like very, very understood. Now, I understood people are concerned that I have violated my group mates' boundaries. And that is, we should be concerned about boundaries, me included. And I had a whole process with my group mates my current ones and former ones, and they are deeply hidden. And I took out their information and I focused the story on me and the pieces they gave me. The book used to be much longer because originally I had included in there information about them. And then I took it out because it doesn't belong to me. But to your point, therapists and people who are used to their way of therapy, which is traditional, which is the majority of group therapy, are very nervous about a lot of the things that Dr. Rosen did from page like 12. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about there's no confidentiality among the group mates. Many traditional group therapies, you sign a contract or you promise not to talk about what happens in the group outside of the group. And here I come and I've written a book about what I've been doing the past 10 years. So There is a lot, I get a lot of feedback. What I have noticed, this is totally anecdotal, but many younger therapists are feeling energized by sort of maybe reinvigorating some of these traditional models. Maybe this strict confidentiality, maybe it just needs to be interrogated. Like, who is that for? Who does it serve? Who does it protect? And Dr. Rosen and his practice, as I understand it from my vantage point, we're all addicts and our diseases really thrived with secrecy. And we were all protecting uncles, grandparents, babysitters. And we just had lost ourselves in this process of secrecy and addiction. And so that's not a tool that he's brought in. Now he has to keep secrecy and confidentiality because he's the doctor and that's his ethics. But I can tell you things about my treatment and what happens in that room. And then it's up to me and my own ethics, like how much do I reveal about other people? And that's something that's part of the risk, right? Of joining a group. And it's not sealed, it's not a sealed container that most people are used to.
And that's so big, right? Because I often talk about that with eating disorders is you're only as sick as your secrets. And so here you go into this group and it's not an eating disorder group for anyone listening. Like if maybe that I should have said that, like the book is not about you going into a group to treat eating disorders, even though that's something you were struggling with. It wasn't the topic. But that is a huge part of recovering from one is unearthing your secrets and not being held down by them. And I don't know if you felt like being in the group you were or the groups you were in with Dr. Rosen also helped you through some of your eating disorder symptoms or.
Oh, 100%. And I wonder too. So I had started out in a 12-step program for eating disorders, and it really, really arrested some really, really lethal behavior I was engaged in around binging and purging. Mm-hmm. And I got to, I guess, a plateau or like a good enough recovery, right? But I had a ton of food secrets still. So I'm going to meetings. I'm considering myself an old timer. I give leads. I sponsor women. Meanwhile, I'm terrified of anyone finding out what I actually eat. That didn't strike me as a problem because I was in such denial. I was so worried they were going to kick me out or tell me I was not in recovery. And Dr. Rosen could tell, I don't know how, but maybe it was obvious now that I think about it. But one day he said to me, why don't you tell the group what you ate yesterday? And it's the first time in group I threw a fit because I would have rather done anything than say, and the behavior wasn't going to kill me. I was in a maintenance secret relationship with apples. You know, at night I was binging on like 6, 10, 12 apples a night. And that's not going to, probably not going to kill me. It was not good for me. And the lethal part of that process was the secret. Mm-hmm. And I had to look at these people and think, I'm going to tell them my, that's my deepest, darkest secret. That came before anything I did with sex, with money, anything. That was my top secret. And my experience was once I began to tell the truth about what I put in my mouth without the expectation of change it, make it better, fix it. Dr. Rosen said, you just tell a witness what you ate after you've eaten it every day. And I was like, I didn't think I could do it, but I committed. And that's the first moment I thought I might just get well here. I might just get well.
And that's the word you put, hope.
Yeah.
Sounds like it instilled some hope in you. And it sounds like that was this huge turning point for you.
Absolutely. And it was a turning point. I wanted a cure. I wanted, oh, great. I'll call up my group mate and say, hey, here's what I ate today. And I wanted it to cure, but I continued to eat more than 3 apples a night for at least another 6 months. There's no cure for the behavior in the sense of snap, it's gone. I had been doing secret food eating for many, many years, and it took a while to straighten myself out. And there was so much shame that first we had to treat the shame. And the way to treat the shame was to turn it over to someone. And once the shame was no longer the centerpiece of my life, that's where hope and light and dreams came in. And I was like, oh, I might not be the biggest piece of you know what on the earth, because I don't know how to eat. I don't know how to eat. I was 28 years old and I did not know how to eat. And I had years of recovery under my belt and was still like a newborn baby. I needed a lot of help.
And so it's so interesting because I do think people go into treatment, therapy, whatever it is, thinking they're going to get answers. They're going to be told what to do.
Yes.
And you weren't.
I know. It's so upsetting. Even today, I do sometimes that desire for an answer. And maybe, you know, sometimes it's described to me as because I'm an addict, I want to shortcut my feelings. And I think I have the idea that an answer will make the pain stop, right? Tell me how to make the pain stop. And pain is not really necessarily always meant to just be stopped. It's oftentimes walked through, learned from, and it's not. When I'm in a sane moment, I recognize Dr. Rosen or my groupmates can't tell me what to do. It's got to come from inside, but they'll hold my hands while I'm super uncomfortable, looking for the next right step for me to take.
But I think that's the beauty of it, is you were being held there, and, you know, we call it distress tolerance. It's tolerating the distress of being in this uncomfortable emotion. And I don't think a lot of people are able to do that much. You know, what you're doing with the apples or your eating disorder is just numbing it out.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? I don't want to tolerate this. I'm going to go eat all these apples, or I'm going to engage in this eating disorder behavior. And that was your solution when you were by yourself.
Yes. Thinking,
this is the way to do it. But you weren't allowed to do that. Like, you had to be accountable for it, right?
Yeah. I didn't know. When looking back now, I mean, I think eating disorders are very complex, and I had a whole history of trauma, and that played a role. But there is also a simple thing that was going on for me, which is I was really, really lonely and terrified of people. And it was just easier to sit and eat, watch Scrubs and eat 10 apples than to feel lonely and take steps to change my life. It was like, well, I'll just eat more apples. And it was taking more and more. It started out 4, then we bumped up to 6. Then once you hit an amount, you know, once you hit 10, well, then round the corner is 12. And I hit that corner and I was like, this is just not going to end. And I didn't know how to stop it until other people intervened.
Was there a fear there in being judged, like you divulging this and people just saying the things maybe to you that you were saying to yourself about how you were eating these apples and all the things you thought? You know, the Ed thoughts and all that, were you afraid they were just going to say all those things back to you?
Oh, I thought that they were going to literally recoil, like push their chairs back away from me. The way that I talk to myself in my worst moments is what I thought would come back at me. And that sounds like, you're disgusting. Mm-hmm. No one's ever going to sleep with you. No one wants to be your friend. It's very mean and it's very wholesale. And it covers every area of my life. And at the time, that very first time that Dr. Rosen said, why don't you tell the group what you ate? And once I calmed down and became willing, I couldn't look at them. I'm like, I've jammed my fist in my eye socket because I don't want to see them be like, ah, oh, you're gross. Mm-hmm. And when fine, so I said it. And then Dr. Rosen's like, open your eyes. I'm like, I don't want to. No, thank you. And then when I did, what I saw back from these, I think there were 5 other people there that day, was just, there was love. There was amusement. I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, they didn't hate me. They were just like, what are you so worked up about? So there was some amusement and curiosity. It wasn't just pure love. And then there was also relatability. Everyone there, like, everybody had a secret. Everybody has degrees of secrets. And there were other people in the circle who had shame around food too. And we were able to connect and walk forward together. And that, I just hadn't experienced that before. It felt like a miracle. And it's like kind of simple. Connect with another person who suffers, and together you walk into the solution. I mean, that's what I was supposed to be doing in my 12-step program, but I was hiding and it wasn't working.
I think you just hit the nail on the head right there. That is the beauty of group, is you get reflected back to you something so different than you experience in your own body. And that's where the healing starts. It's like, oh, wait, I can experience something different. And get it. You mentioned Yalom, you know, at the end and, you know, credits, and it's like Yalom, like discussed how to do the group process, and he talked about it as a microcosm of the outside world and relating to people and healing. And you experienced, just as you described that, you experienced something so different being in this group than maybe you had experienced even in your relationship with yourself or people in the outside world. As you said, you had a history of trauma and very maybe negative experiences, but to be in this group and have a safe place where you could be yourself and open up and get such different feedback, and even people that, yeah, I got it, I'm there too, or I've experienced that emotion, and be able to contain it,
yeah,
work through it. Like, that is so powerful. And I think that's the important part about group that maybe people don't understand, is it's a safe place to work through things that are very scary.
Yes. Oh, 100%. Like, I think the work that I was able to do, people ask me all the time, for example, well, could you have gotten well in one-on-one? Like, at some point I would have stopped like lying and performing for my individual therapist, presumably, and I would have gotten down to business. And I certainly think that's possible. And I kind of will never know, because I chose the group route. But what I do know is that watching other people gave me, it's like jumping off the high dive, right? I'd watched other people touch their own darkness and bring it to light. And it made me want to try. It made me brave. And they never, my group, even to this day, I'm 20 years and 1 month in to group therapy with Dr. Rosen. And still to this day, they never say what I think they're going to say. I mean, every now and then it's like, if I did something awesome with affirming myself or whatever, they'll say, yeah, good job. But many, anything where there's any murk in my own psyche, mm-hmm. They never hate me the way I think they're going to. And they also challenge me. It's not all they, you know, hold me in this very quiet way. Sometimes they're like, hey, you know, you're neglecting yourself here, or why did you make that decision? Or do you think this job is working for you? And those are confrontations that are scarier, because they feel sharper than we love you, but they're just as vital, and they've moved my life forward just the same, you know?
So as you say, those number of years, I wonder if anyone listening might be like, oh my gosh, I have to do this for decades and keep going. And I don't know if people have asked you that, like, oh my gosh, doesn't that feel like it's too long? Or do you feel like you can never get out? Like, what? I don't know if people have asked you that. Like, what do you say?
Every conversation people say, who gets to leave? Do you ever get to leave? And it's my experience is I know I can leave anytime I want. I don't have the idea that my life will fall apart if I leave Dr. Rosen. I've gotten an incredible amount of skills. I have been able to build a life full of love inside and outside of group. And so I choose to keep going because I like having the support. I still do hard things all the time, and I want support, and it's already built in. Like, I'm not going to have to like put it together, you know, if there's a crisis in my family or during, like when the pandemic hit, I already had a group that was online. I didn't have to scramble. So I sort of like that. And I recognize it is a huge luxury and a privilege that I am able to spend 180 weeks in group exploring my mental health, meeting with other people, being part of their stories. So yes, I do believe you can leave. I can leave group. I don't think you have to do therapy forever. It so happens that Dr. Rosen's model is like, how I sort of hear it is, you still want support, there's always a chair for you. If you want to keep doing this, and if you want to go, let us bless you and send you on your way. And I'm sort of a creature of habit. Actually, last night I was doing a conversation about the book, and somebody said to me, this was an awesome question and super fair. She said, do you think it's a feature of your addictive personality that you just keep going to group? And I was like, that is very insightful. And I think, how could I say no? Like, I'm totally an addict. I've done 20 years of therapy with the same therapist. It does smell a little like addiction to me. And what I believe for myself is that it's the proper use of that addictive side of me. Like, it has a good, I have a good outcome from going to group, and I want to keep having that good outcome. And I hope and I trust that if the outcome is no longer good, that I'll bid them farewell and go on my way. But I think that's a funny and fair question. I'm sure listeners are thinking, doesn't this woman have anything else to do with her time and money? It's a fair question.
Does it ever come up in your family or personal life where you've been like, oh my gosh, group's getting in the way of us doing things, or, you know, it's becoming expensive or time consuming, or gosh, mom, we want you home, or your husband or anybody's been like, all right, when's it going to stop?
Yeah, that's a very good question too. So the people that I live with, they seem to have the idea that I do better when I go to groups. They're like, you know, if we're going on a trip, why don't we go after mommy comes back from Dr. Rosen on that session or whatever. So I can appreciate they see something in me that I assume is there. And at the same time, as I've gotten, you know, I worked so hard to have this family, my children and my husband, it would never be my expectation that group, that I get to like shaft them for group. So I used to like organize before when I was single, right? I would organize trips and all my everything so I could be at every session. I was like really into it. Now I'm like, we're going on vacation. I'll see you guys later. And I don't sweat it the way I used to, because I'm not a desperate on the edge woman anymore. And it plays a different role in my life. So my husband hasn't asked, you know, how long, but you know, I am aware of the costs of this. It is not a cheap hobby. I'm always like, it's kind of like a round of golf twice a week, every week. And it's been important to me to be self-supporting. And so I have a fund for my mental health. And I also want to like model for my children, like, this is a priority. It is important to me. This is what my money is for. It's not the only thing it's for, but this is an important resource that I want to have time and money to do.
Thank you for saying that. Actually, I think mental health does not get enough of a praise, or it's not talked about how it's an investment in yourself, and we need it. People look at it like, oh, you go to therapy. If you go to therapy, it's like right when you're in crisis, or right. It's not like you keep your mental health, in check, or you maintain it. And so you've done such a great job, I think, of saying like, this is important and this is something necessary for me. And like you said, just hearing your story, it's, you know, to instill hope in people that, wow, you can't, you know, reading your book was like, obviously you made so many changes and transitioned your life through group and therapy. And I wish there was more stories like that out there. I think if people told their stories and they were honest and open and vulnerable, you were so vulnerable. Thank you. I think that's the power of your book. You know, who does that? Who is that vulnerable? Because, you know, I think you said like, oh my gosh, my kids ever read this, right? Like,
yes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. I really think that to the extent that my vulnerability comes through in the book, I learned that in group. And from the beginning of writing this whole project, I, in order to honor the work that I did there, I was going to have to just go there. Mm-hmm. Or why write the book? I could pick anything to write about. I could write a novel. I could do something else. But when I settled on this, it just became very clear to me. And I'm also an all or nothing person, right? There was either going to be no book, or there was going to be like, we're going to go there. Bulimia, pinworms, trauma, all these men. And I love books like that. I love art like that. I love comedians who are like that. Some of the I was hugely impressed, like stand-up comedian like Hannah Gadsby talking about her sexual assault and in detail. And I want to create work like that, because that reaches people. That reaches people who have suffered or who are suffering. And that to me seems the point of making something to put in the world.
And that's another reason I'm glad to have you on the podcast, because my whole thing here is to have real people talking about their real life experiences. And I mean, your book is very real. I'm actually curious, the people that you wrote about, did you have to get permission from them to write about your experiences with them, or did you not even think about that?
Oh, no, I thought about it from day one, because once the story is taking shape, and I think everybody who writes a memoir has to confront, like, wait, am I going to write about my ex-husband? Wait, what about my kids? Mm-hmm. You have to ask all those questions if you're going to put this, quote, true story out into the world. And also, I was going to stay in group. And so I had to let them know from the jump, hey, I think I'm writing about us guys. And at first they just sort of humored me, and I didn't, you know, we didn't do anything where they signed anything, but definitely I sent them drafts all through the process saying, if you want to change your name, I mean, I changed everybody's name, but like, if you don't like that I gave you the name Brad, hit me with something. You want to be Clint? You want to be Jack? And I wanted them in that part of the process. So that's a little bit unorthodox as a writer, but I did let them all in. And then once the book was done, I also had people I was no longer in group with, and I tracked a bunch of them down to let them know, because I just didn't want to go out into the world with something that hurt somebody else. And I didn't want to surprise anybody. And some people I lost touch with and couldn't find. Some people I was counseled, just leave them alone. I was like, oh, okay. As for a lot of people are curious about, I wrote about a lot of ex-boyfriends, mm-hmm. and people ask me all the time about Jeremy. And all along, I was going to show him the book because he's a tender-hearted person that I wanted to honor. He actually passed away before, mm-hmm. like 2 years before the book even came out. So that was, and so did Marty, passed away as well. I was no longer in group with him. And so that was really, I was like, oh, it felt like a missed opportunity. Like I believe we would have connected around some of the stories that I told in the book. And as for the other people, some of the ex-boyfriends, I have not heard from them. I don't imagine that I will.
Okay. I mean, how brave for you, honestly. And
oh, scary.
Yeah. But I do just applaud you for that, because I do think anyone listening today, just, I think it is going to instill some hope if anyone does want to read your book, or after listening to you, or if anyone has. I know my group was so thrilled to have you on, because they got a lot out of reading your book. They felt like it was, I think I told you beforehand, they felt like reading it was being in another group. They got some healing from it, just reading it. Because it does have this flavor of just like, wow, you know what? This, I can get better. If I work on things, I stick with things, go to therapy, go to group. Wow. Look how much your life, such a transition, your whole life changed.
I can't even believe it sometimes myself. And when I was thinking about, I didn't set out to write the book to help people. I would love to say that, because it makes me sound like a better person than I am. I was more motivated, like, I think this is a good story. I think I can pull this off. And now I see the potential. But what I would want anybody to know is, even if group is not the tool that you use, there are ways to transform your life. And it can get messy. It can get a little uncomfortable. That doesn't mean it's not working. Because at any point, if there's so many points in the book where I could have pulled the plug, like the pain got too high. I was watching other people come into group after me and get the things I wanted. Like I went to tons of weddings for people who came into group after me. And it was like devastating, devastating. And I felt like I'm behind. It doesn't work. I'm untreatable. And I stuck around long enough to get the things I wanted and was working towards, but when you're in the middle of the story, you don't know the end. You don't know if it's your knots are ever going to come loose. And I just want people to know that there are solutions and you're worth looking for them. And even if you don't choose group, choose something, because you don't have to stay mired in misery and awful isolation. Like there are better ways.
Well said. And I think that's a great point too. I hear so often from people like, well, when am I going to get better? Or, well, they got better before me, so maybe I'm hopeless. Or, well, come on, doc, when is it going to change? Or, you know, it's like this need to know, or like, well, you know, give me the timeline. Or, you know, I get DMs from people. It's like, well, I've never gotten better, so it's not going to happen for me.
Yes. I totally lived there. And I can remember, I mean, months and weeks and years of going into group and say, what's your proof? I'd be screaming at Dr. Rosa, what's your proof this works for me? You believe in group. Maybe I'm the one person for whom your almighty tool does not work. And he would always say the same thing to me. He's like, ask your group mates if they think you're getting better. Mm-hmm. He's probably right that I wouldn't have taken it from him. And someone would yell out, well, now you live with a roommate. Oh, you have this great job. You've paid off your credit card debt. You have had a couple of relationships and they didn't last, but you've at least done some of the growing up you didn't do when you were in your adolescence because you were busy binging and purging. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of hard with all these voices coming at me, pointing out, I had my eyes on this ultimate prize. Like I wanted to be a size, you know, certain size of my body. I wanted to be married and I wanted to feel like I was a real person. And there was a lot I had to do to mm-hmm. get where I started to there. And I didn't count anything. I had the habit of not wanting to count the incremental gains I was making. I just was like, well, where's my husband? Well, where are my babies? And everyone's like, well, you know, you just bought a condo. I'm like, I don't care. I'm by myself. So learning how to celebrate and experience incremental mental health gains was like, that was one of the hardest lessons I had to learn.
And great to get the feedback from multiple people.
Yes. Yeah. Because different people could see different things in me. And I think if Dr. Rosen had like reverted to some kind of pep talk, like, look how far you've come, it would have been so self-serving, right? Like he did it. He's the great doctor.
Right.
So I think that's another benefit of group. Like those people, they don't have to love me or see me. And they did. And that part felt pretty transformative along the way.
And I'm wondering too, for anyone who's in the throes of eating disorder treatment and maybe they feel like, oh gosh, they're getting better. And even in a group and getting feedback, like, gosh, you've made all this change, but then maybe they get back into a space where all of their eating disorder symptoms come back with a vengeance and they're going, see, it doesn't work. Like, this is not working. You suck. Therapy yeah. doesn't work. Like, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I would say, I hear you. The jagged process of mental health, specifically around my eating disorder, I have days when I wake up and think, maybe I'll just not eat today and I'll run a lot. I have those thoughts. I don't act on them, but my symptoms flare up. Absolutely. I just went on a trip. I went to Alaska with my family and I mean, I hadn't been anywhere in forever because of the pandemic. And I forgot how vulnerable I am when I travel. It just, the hatred of my body soars. I have less control over my food. We're traveling. Everything seems like it's all fried or it's all full of butt. Like I get crazy and it feels like I'm 17 years old again. And I felt so vulnerable and I had to just get back to basics. Like, what are the tools? Like, reaching out to someone else, like telling, I mean, my husband's not a person who suffers from an eating disorder, but I can't hold all that in. Like, I just had to turn him one day and say, I hate my body so much. Like, I can't even focus on these glaciers or these whales. I don't care. I'm thinking about my body. And even just like pricking the silence and the isolation helps me be a little bit freer. But the truth is, next time I go on a trip, I'm going to be very humbled by and do a little more prep work because the disease, I consider it a disease. I don't know if that's helpful language to other people, but my symptoms can come back at any time and I can be very vulnerable. And I just take that vulnerability as a signal to stay connected to myself and to stay connected to the people who hold me and not try to do it by myself. And it is tempting to think, well, I guess I just stuck as a recovering person. Is very tempting to go there, but that's just another symbol. That's just another symptom, right? The negative destructive thinking. I have it and I pray for a daily reprieve and sticking close to others and not holding it secretly has helped me tremendously.
Thank you for sharing that. Like, again, like your vulnerability is fantastic because, you know, I think people wonder for themselves if they have these thoughts or something comes up like, oh, I failed at therapy. See? Like,
yeah. I have really struggled too recently around eating issues, thinking to myself, I'm 48. I feel like I'm way beyond the demographic that should be struggling with body image. Like, I'm supposed to be thinking about voter suppression and Kabul and my children. Like, I'm surprised I still have a lot of the same thoughts, not all the time, but I have struggled with some of the exact same thoughts I had when I was 12, when I was 17, when I was 20. I'm like, am I ever going to age out of body dysmorphia or eating disorder? And I think maybe the answer is no. Like, I'm 48. I have to be aware of who I am and my vulnerabilities around food and eating and body. And some days it feels like a superpower because I can connect to other women and men too, but really for me, it's only been women, but I can connect with people around that. Some days it feels like that superpower. And some days it just feels like a heavy cross to bear. And I think anybody that has an eating disorder like mine knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, and if I can impart any words, like, I had years of eating disorder, you know, struggles, and, you know, why one thing is I want to break that myth that, like, it never goes away. So even at 48, I'm hoping for you to instill that hope in you, like, yes, it does go away. Cause I always envisioned my head, like, in prison walls and going, I'm never going to get out of this. I'm going to be stuck here forever. And if someone would have told me, like, I would never have an eating disorder thought again in my life, you're so stupid. You're, like, lying to me. Get away from me. Like, I told them to shut up. It's never going to happen.
And you had the experience of a total freedom.
Yeah. Which is bizarre. Because I said, there's no way that's ever going to happen. It was like my entire life. I was just, everything. I was just like 99% of my daily life and thoughts. And I didn't even want to treat eating disorders, to be honest with you, because I'm a therapist.
Wow, you always have an incredible story.
You know, I was like, I don't want to like have that, that thought of, oh, all therapists go into therapy to treat their own stuff. And, like, bring them into the room. Right. I was like, I'm not going to be that therapist. But, you know, I got to this point where I was like, oh, it's not even in there. Like, I don't get triggered. This is fantastic. But I want to instill that hope in people, like, oh my gosh, you can get there. Cause getting there is a very interesting place. Like, whoa. Cause I know that myth is out there. Like, oh, it never goes away. Come on, doc, you must have something. And it's like, it's a great place to be. So I do hope you get there, truly.
Thank you. I'll take your hope all the way. I appreciate you sharing that, because that is, I've had some flare ups and I'm like, oh, come on. I wanted to go away forever. So it's nice to hear from someone who has had that experience. It's awesome.
I just look at when you have flare ups, it's your body's communicating to you, like, something feels out of control or something feels painful, and it's all it really is. And just looking at it like, well, thank you for communicating, but I don't need to have edit going on.
Yes, totally. Yeah. That explains why it flared up during travel. Right.
So, but yeah, I think people just fall into the spiral of, oh, see, like, I'm failing. And Ed just gets in there and like, see, like, you're not better. You're still a failure. You're not good enough. And you just spiral down.
Right. Yes, exactly.
So, well, thank you so much for being here. I think you're very inspiring. And anyone who hasn't read your book, just want to encourage you. It's really a great book. It's an easy read. It's fun. And it does instill a lot of hope. So any last parting words for anyone who's listening?
I really just want to encourage people, if you could just find one person you're willing to share a little bit of your secret that you're holding like a stash. It doesn't have to be a therapist. It doesn't have to be a psychotherapy group. It could be a friend, a colleague, a priest, a rabbi. Any amount of sharing a secret helps the light come in. That's what I really, really believe. And that's what I hope readers will take. And I want to say thank you to you for all the work you do. I'm so happy people are talking about eating disorders and bringing hope into the conversation. It's really, really what we all need.
Thank you so much. And if anyone wants to find you or connect with you, is there a way to do that? Or
yeah, I'm on Instagram at Christy O. Tate. And that's probably the best place. I have a writing website, but it's just sort of like, it's not interactive. It's just like a list of my writing. Okay. And that's www.christytate.com. But come visit me on Instagram. And I love to talk about any of these issues or anything in the book.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again so much. And Well, I'll have all that information on the show notes on the website. So anyone who wants to find that, I will have all that information there. All right. Thank you for such a great show.
Thank you so much. Take care.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guest are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.